Works of art go missing in a variety of calamitous ways, as we've seen in our previous programs. Famous pictures are stolen from museums, volcanoes destroy entire libraries, Nazis loot manuscripts from helpless Jewish scholars. These are stories that are as compelling as the lost works of art that they chronicle, and with the passage of time, they become like myths. Occasionally, though, the story is not nearly so grand. Important works get mislaid, or individuals get in a muddle and lose them. I know this all too well. I lost one myself, and it's a sad story. Instructive, funny, and a little embarrassing. It concerns the personal papers, the archive, that is, of the spy Kim Philby, immortalized in 20th century imagery as the Third Man. It happened like this. For several years in the late 1980s, I was a regular visitor to Antibes to see Graham Greene, from whom I was buying a series of manuscripts, letters, and books. Sometime before he died in 1991, Graham, who was a longtime friend of Philby's, suggested that it might be profitable and enjoyable for me to go to Moscow to meet Kim Philby's widow, Rufina. According to Green, Mrs. Philby might just be interested in the sale of some of Philby's books and all of the papers that he'd accumulated during his Moscow years. Green, who'd kept up a correspondence with Philby and twice visited him in Moscow, was well aware of the importance of Philby's library. According to his nephew, the bookseller Nicholas Dennis,
Graham clearly enjoyed the frisson of keeping in contact with Philby. But they maintained their friendship in the understanding that their communications would be shown by each other to their respective bosses. They were both well aware of this. People often talk as if there was some double agency in that. But they were both just very experienced old spies who knew precisely what would be done with their letters. It was clear that they liked each other very much and respected each other. Although they were on different sides, they were both loyal to things that they both considered more important than country. They both had an integrity that they recognized.
Kim Philby, you may remember, was the cleverest, most important, and most elusive of that set of spies. Guy Burgess, Donald MacLean, and Anthony Blunt were the others, who'd been at Cambridge in the 1930s and subsequently worked for the Soviets. By 1963, Philby had been rumbled and largely discredited, though never arrested for treason, and he was working as a journalist in Beirut when a defector from the Soviets informed MI6, what they had suspected for some time, that Philby was a Soviet agent. What happened next could only have come straight from a carry-on spying film. An MI6 operative was dispatched to Beirut to confront Philby and to bring him home to London to face trial. "We have you dead to rights," said this agent. "You come back to London right now, you bad spy." "No," said Philby. "Would you come if I said please?" said the MI6 man. "No," said Philby again, and commenced packing his bags. Disconsolate at this rejection, the MI6 fellow returned to London, but by the time he'd got back, Philby was on a boat to Moscow, where he was soon to be reunited with Burgess and MacLean. But if MI6 didn't quite know how to handle Philby, neither did the KGB. He'd been the source of some useful information, no doubt about that, but there was something, even to the Soviets, a little, shall we say, untrustworthy about the urbane Englishman. They set him up nicely with a good two-bedroom flat and a toothsome red-haired interpreter called Rufina, who later became the fourth Mrs. Philby, for Kim changed his sexual allegiances even more frequently than his national ones. And 10 years passed, slowly. At last, finally, the barriers came down, and Philby began to present what he called his English seminars at the KGB. His purpose was to train Soviet agents how to pass when they were working in England, which involved an astonishing amount of nonsense about MCC ties and the rules of cricket, which clubs to join, and the arcana associated with a public school and Oxbridge education. I met one of these students, let's call him Michael B., on my trip to Moscow in 1993 to examine Philby's library and papers. He was, he told me, acting as Mrs. Philby's agent in our negotiations, and that, he said proudly, he'd been a student of Kim's. How delightful to meet you, he said, shaking my hand. I do so miss London. I had the most marvellous time there. Such a delightful city. You worked in London, I said. Yes, he said suavely. I was a TASS correspondent for 7 years. Hold on a minute, I said. I'm new to this. You were a student of Kim's, and then you went to London. He nodded. So you were a KGB spy. Of course, he chortled. Now entrepreneur. In Michael's charming but watchful company, Mrs. Philby and I began to go through Kim's library. He had thousands of volumes he'd had plenty of time to read, and various friends, like Graham Greene, had been generous in sending him reading material. As I browsed, a few of the books virtually demanded a return to England. There was Kim's heavily annotated Handbook of Marxism from the 1930s, which was absolutely wonderful. But best of all was a copy of Spycatcher. You remember the book. It was briefly banned under the Official Secrets Act in England in 1989 and had been written by a former employee of MI5 called Peter Wright. This copy was inscribed to Philby by Graham Greene. Now there's something, a celebrated book about spying presented by the finest writer about espionage to the most famous of spies. I had to have it. And Mrs. Philby had a very distinct interest in money and was constantly in a state about inflation in post-communist Moscow. Perhaps you might like to sell me a couple of books then, I asked. She would. During the afternoon, with both of us feeling a little skittish due to Michael's uncharacteristic absence, she and I did a deal on a few of the books, and I gave her £1,500 in cash. Her eyes glowed. I considered making an offer for one further book that I craved. I forget its title, it wasn't anything in particular, but it bore the inscription for Melinda, that is the wife of Donald MacLean, and it read, An Orgasm a Day Keeps the Doctor Away, with love from Kim. But it's possible to press your luck too far, and I regretfully put the book back on the shelf. And Mrs. Philby, to be fair, was a generous host. During my 4 days in Moscow, she showed me round the local parks, churches, and places of interest. On several of these perambulations, it was impossible not to notice that we were being followed by a sauntering, portly, slightly florid gentleman, dressed in a cravat, spats, a bright waistcoat, a houndstooth tweed jacket. He didn't look local. He made no attempt to conceal himself. How could he? Rather the reverse. He wanted me to know that he was there. It was the man from Sotheby's. It's no wonder he was on the prowl. The Philby papers were wonderful. There were all of his notebooks containing the English seminar material, an unfinished draft of an autobiography, a considerable amount of documentation concerning his status at the KGB, letters from various important Russian and English figures, diaries, and unpublished articles. Considered together, the material gave a wonderfully clear and hitherto unknown account of Philby's Moscow years. Rufina, Michael, and I agreed that I could offer all of this to the British Library at a price of some £60,000. Rufina's eyes were wet with anticipation. Michael looked distinctly pleased. We ate caviar. We drank champagne. I paid. The British Library, to be fair, needed governmental approval before they could proceed with such a potentially controversial acquisition. But shortly after the proposal was sent to the Foreign Office, I received a phone call from Moscow. It was Michael. Rick, he said in a tone lacking his customary warmth, we are not happy. What's the matter, Michael? I said. Those books you have purchased from Rufina when I was absent. I do not like the price you have put on them. Now, this was genuinely astonishing. I'd taken the books and put them on a shelf hidden behind my desk in my office, having jotted a figure for insurance purposes in each one. It added up to something like £5,000. No one other than myself and my working colleagues had seen them. At night, we close our shop, lock it, and an extremely good burglar alarm is set. Those are not prices, I said. Anyway, how do you know? Never mind, he said. I have lost confidence in you. Listen, Michael, I said, unsure where this was going. I flew to Moscow. I spent 4 nights in a hotel. I gave Rufina a free appraisal of the papers and the books in the library. I spent hundreds of pounds entertaining you both, and I do need to make some profit. This is called capitalism, and it's how my wife and children come to eat. We do not understand this, Michael said. We are just simple Russians. Simple Russians! Simple Russians, I said. You've got to be kidding. You were high up in the KGB, and I am a simple bookseller. The deal is off, he said, and the phone was put down. At the British Library Department of Manuscripts, the unfailingly genial Michael Barry, who had painstakingly negotiated the purchase of the archive, was distinctly unhappy when he heard my news. It's obvious, you stupid boy, he said testily. It was by now abundantly clear that I was out of my depth, as if I'd wandered into the script of a Graham Greene fantasy without being told my lines. So I rang Michael back in Moscow. Michael, I said, trying to sound as if I knew what I was doing and was comfortable, I'm calling to apologize. I've been so tied up with the details of this archive that I rather neglected to mention your introductory commission. There was a short silence. In such cases, I said, it is customary in my trade to pay the seller's agent a fee, say 10% of the price. That would come to £6,000 to you. I could give it to you in cash if you want. Are you trying to bribe me? He said. Yes, I said. Is it working? He put the phone down. I don't know. Maybe the man from Sotheby's paid him more. Who knows? Or maybe he did it for love of his old mentor, Kim Philby, or of his younger wife, Rufina. When the Philby material came up for auction at Sotheby's London in August of 1994, Rufina had taken the decision to split up the archive into its constituent parts, presumably to increase the takings, though actually the final figure was more or less what the British Library would have paid in the first place. But the material, in its broken-up form, was purchased by a wide variety of buyers, most of them unidentifiable, and Kim Philby's papers were distributed in bits round the world. Anyone wishing to do research on Philby's Moscow years would now have to search desperately and sometimes fruitlessly to reassemble the material. Ironically enough, Philby might have been pleased by this. The less paper trail, the less anyone would ever know what really went on. Graham Greene, his nephew observed, might well have felt similarly himself.
Graham's preference was that his own annotated library should be dispersed to the four winds, precisely so that people wouldn't know too much about what he was thinking.
But I can't help feeling that there must have been something I could have done. Perhaps after my phone call from Michael, I should have caught the night flight to Moscow, my pockets stuffed with cash. At least, in person, I could have put the case, not for my sake or theirs, but for the integrity of the archive. By the time the Philby papers were dispersed, it wasn't only Michael who'd lost confidence in me.